Hello, this is Isaac Gurdetsky, Project Manager at Manhattan Institute's Center for Legal Policy, and I'm joined by my colleague James Copeland, Director of the Center for Legal Policy, to discuss his latest finding featured on the Center's Proxy Monitor website, which aims to shed light on the influence of outside shareholder proposals on publicly traded corporations. Central to the website is the Proxy Monitor database, a record of all proxy proposals submitted by shareholders of the 200 largest American public companies for the last 7 years, including the current 2012 proxy season. Jim, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Isaac.
This current finding, the final installment of the series of four findings you've authored this year, reveals some distinct and maybe even potentially alarming shareholder proposal trends for the 2012 proxy season. Could you please begin by outlining some of those trends which your analysis has identified?
Sure. And it's important to realize these some things aren't that different from what we've been observing all the way back to 2006. Some things are different. And I'll try to flesh out what I mean by that. We don't have all Fortune 200 companies done with their annual meetings yet. I want to emphasize that as well. But we have 172 of them as of the end of June, which is basically when the proxy season wraps up. So we can say pretty clearly that what we're observing is the trend for this year and compare it to prior years. In terms of the number of proposals companies have been getting, it's basically the same as last year. A tiny uptick, but rounded off, it's about 1.4 shareholder proposals per company, the same as last year. That's a little bit down from the 2008 to 2010 trend. And the reason for that is that in 2010, in the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill, the Congress mandated annual or biennial or triennial votes on executive compensation plans that all shareholders were going to have to do. And so while there were a number of those proposals calling for such shareholder advisory votes on pay plans, they've now been mandated, so you don't see any more of those shareholder proposals. But while we've seen some consistency in the number of proposals, we've seen some shifts in the type of proposals. Traditionally, in addition to these executive compensation proposals, we saw a lot of environmental proposals. This year, those are only about 10% of the total number of proposals that we see, 9-10%. And what we've seen instead as the most numerous proposal are these proposals designed to limit or to increase disclosure of corporate political spending or lobbying. That's about 20% of all proposals. We still see a fair number of executive compensation proposals that are different from these shareholder advisory vote proposals. We also are seeing about 12% of all proposals relating to chairman independence or keeping the position of chairman and CEO separate in the company. And those latter two classes of proposals, as well as political spending proposals, are being driven significantly by labor union pension funds. And that's something we really wanted to analyze in this final finding, because that's something we've continued to maintain an interest in, because the ERISA, the laws, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, requires that labor union pension funds vote their shares and engage in the shareholder process to maximize share value, because they're trying to protect all these pensioners. And if, in fact, they have other motives beyond that, that's something we've been consistently interested in and we were testing for this year.
Well, on the topic of those other motives, you devote a portion of your analysis in this finding to the examination of the role of labor union pension funds in the shareholder proposal process. In your careful tracking of the current season, is there any evidence to prove that often mentioned hypothesis that such participation by union funds is not really related to maximizing share returns for union member pensions, but more about organizing campaigns and advancing the union's agenda?
I think so. Again, this evidence is only suggestive. We're never going to be able to prove it. I want to emphasize that it's not just me or the Manhattan Institute making these questions. In March of last year, the Office of Inspector General for the Department of Labor and the Obama administration raised the question of whether unions were, through their pension funds, only operating to try to maximize share value. And last summer, the D.C. Circuit of Appeals in a major decision raised the same question. And we've seen some folks advocating for this, most prominently Harold Meyerson in the Washington Post recently, who sort of said, oh, this is a good way for unions to advance their agenda, not seemingly unaware of their ERISA obligations here. There's a couple ways we test for this empirically, and then I sort of went in and looked more anecdotally, specifically at the companies that were getting a lot of attention from the labor unions. Empirically, first of all, we looked at the types of proposals that the labor unions were introducing. And even though these are the most numerous overall proposals, in other words, political spending, executive compensation, chairman independence, of course, the overall numbers are driven in significant part by the labor union participation because they back 36% of all proposals in this space. When we looked at them, they actually do even more of these proposals, disproportionate number of these proposals. 25% of all labor union-backed proposals involve political spending or lobbying. Another 40% involve either executive compensation or chairman independence. And what does that tell us? The latter we've identified in prior years, the executive compensation and chairman independence types of proposals, as being particularly sensitive to upper management, because basically what you're doing is challenging their ability to get paid, or telling the joint chairman and CEO of the company, you've either got to give up day-to-day operations of the company or take a boss on top of you. Clearly, this is something that upper management's going to be sensitive to, and it might indicate that the unions are trying to get leverage over the company. Of course, it also might mean that the union's simply skeptical of management. The political spending thing as well, it's possible that the unions view this as a major threat to shareholder return, but it's also quite plausible that the unions would say, well, we're against a lot of what the corporations are spending money on in the political process. They're often adverse to our interests, and so we're going to fight it. So what we do in the sort of second round of tests is look at what companies and industries are actually getting targeted. And looking this empirically at the broad swath of companies, we saw what we've generally seen in prior years. In other words, sectors like the financial services sector, the retail sector, are particularly likely to be getting proposals by labor-backed pension funds, and these also happen to be the sectors that are openly being targeted in union organizing campaigns. And specifically, you see certain companies that are getting multiple proposals that are publicly announced by the labor unions as organizing targets, namely banks like Bank of America, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, and retail companies like Rite Aid, Safeway, and Walmart. There's some anomalies to this, and so we started to poke at those, say in the healthcare sector, the energy sector, which are a little bit different. They're not necessarily broad sector targets for union campaigns. And when we looked at those, we saw pretty clearly that the companies were not being targeted for share price performance, or certainly didn't seem like that. So when we looked at ExxonMobil, which got multiple proposals, its shares did significantly better in the last year relative to Royal Dutch Shell or ConocoPhillips or BP, only being outperformed by Chevron, and that only slightly. Similarly, Anadarko Petroleum shares were pretty flat year over year as compared to significant declines in its peer group like Chesapeake Energy or Halliburton or Schlumberger. And similarly, Abbott Labs, which received six proposals, the most of any industry in the Fortune, any company in the Fortune 200, six of only eight introduced in the healthcare sector overall, its shares did significantly better than GlaxoSmithKline or Merck or Novartis, only being outperformed by Pfizer. So something else is probably going on here other than being worried about the share price performance of these companies. And when you start looking at the political contributions, well, it turns out Exxon and Anadarko, unlike a lot of companies, disproportionately give money to Republican candidates. And Anadarko also has been involved in natural gas fracking, which is a controversial and politically charged process, especially for labor unions, given the unionization in the coal sector, which is a competitor to natural gas fracking. And then Abbott Labs, its CEO has been very public in supporting efforts to form public employee unions in Illinois and Wisconsin. So those are at least plausible interpretations of what's going on here with the union activism.
That's very interesting. It seems, you know, this issue of corporate political spending, especially 2 years after Citizens United was decided, has garnered significant attention both in the shareholder proposal process, as you just mentioned, and in national media outlets like the Wall Street Journal, which has been following this topic closely. Could you explain why this is such a hot button issue and how it has played out during this current proxy season?
Well, it's a hot button issue because, for one thing, it's a presidential election year. A lot of folks are energized with it. And Citizens United, of course, which held simply that the First Amendment applies to associational speech, including corporate and labor union speech, which was a fairly unexceptional holding in one sense, and the other sense was arguably a major reversal of sorts for what the court had previously been willing to stake itself out on, and at a minimum overturned limitations on what corporations could do that dated back to 1947 with the Taft-Hartley Act. That really energized a lot of folks. Now, public corporations, it turns out, aren't actually spending a lot of money directly in the political process. Less than 1% of the money that went to the super PACs that spent most of the money in the Republican presidential primaries came from public companies. You did see some from private companies, which have closely held shareholder structures, and it's not that surprising you'd see that, but you still saw about 86% of all the money coming from wealthy individuals in terms of direct spending. Corporations do spend a lot on lobbying. They do give significant money to trade associations that sort of present a united corporate message. But we've seen a lot of folks worried about corporate political spending, and I think that's primarily what's going on here. Now, the dominant push here has been for disclosure of certain corporate political spending. It's been spearheaded by the Center for Political Accountability. It was headed by a former Democratic congressional staffer named Bruce Fried. He's introduced, or through others have introduced variants of his proposal, pretty closely tracking his basic language at a number of different companies. What we've seen overall is that there's been a significant increase in the number of these political spending proposals. So if you were in the Fortune 200 this year, you were 28% likely to face a shareholder proposal related to political spending or lobbying, up from only 9% in 2008, and significantly more than it was in 2011 as well. Now, the actual vote totals have been falling in terms of across the full Fortune 200, across all of these proposals. Only 17% of shareholders on average backed these proposals this year as compared to 22% in 2011. Now, that having been said, part of the reason for that decline is you see more aggressive proposals getting introduced this year relative to prior years, notably a proposal that's been backed by North Star Asset Management beginning for the first time last year, which is seeking a shareholder advisory vote on political spending, not unlike the executive compensation votes that are now mandatory under Dodd-Frank. And you also, even this year, have seen Trillium Asset Management, another social investing fund, seeking a prohibition on all corporate political spending. And so these get very, very low vote totals. But even separating out just those basic political spending disclosure proposals from the Center for Political Accountability, the support there's fallen from 26.6% last year to 22.7% this year. The CPA suggests that in part this is due to the fact that companies have changed their behavior. Doubtless that's true. Whether the behavior amounts to significant political disclosures of the type that the CPA is calling for is more questionable and hard to test. And it could be that the companies have actually just been more aggressive in communicating their position and what they actually do disclose to their institutional shareholders. But in any event, none of these proposals are getting close to passing. None of them this year at the Fortune 200 has even reached a 40% voting threshold.
That's very interesting. And just to step back, one last quick question outside of the analysis of your finding on the corporate political participation issue generally. There's been disagreement as of late regarding the impact of corporate political expenditures on share value, and the prevailing thought has always been that such expenditures tend to benefit shareholders. But recent studies come to a contrary conclusion that corporate political spending negatively impacts share value. What are your thoughts on this debate?
Well, this question is actually an important one, and it might seem pretty obvious or intuitive that, well, if a corporation is spending money on politics, they're doing it because it's going to generally benefit that corporation. It may not help everybody else, but it's generally going to benefit that corporation. That makes some of these proposals a little bit dicey when you start stepping back from it, because while if you or I hold shares in a company, we can vote however we want. These institutional investors largely are trying to vote to maximize share value. That's their fiduciary duty to the folks that own shares through the mutual funds or pension funds that we're talking about. So you've got to basically, if you want to convince these institutional shareholders to back these proposals, convince them that somehow this political spending hurts the companies and hurts their share value of the company that they own stock in. Generally, this is, like I said, it's counterintuitive, but there have been three recent academic studies, the two that have gotten the most attention by John Coates at Harvard Law School, which argue the contrary, that in fact there's an inverse relationship between corporate political spending and share returns as he measures them. We were skeptical of this, so we commissioned a study by Robert Shapiro and Doug Dowson. Robert Shapiro, the lead author there, we consciously picked somebody who wasn't going to be accused of being some right-wing guy. So he's the co-founder of the Progressive Policy Institute and a former member of the Commerce Department, Deputy Secretary of the Commerce Department under Bill Clinton, or Undersecretary, I guess was his formal title. He oversaw the Bureau of Economic Analysis there, and he's consulted for every major Democratic presidential campaign dating back to Bill Clinton, including Gore, Kerry, and Obama. And what they found when they looked at this was the Coates studies were out of step with the vast majority of studies that have been done in this area, and that there were some methodological problems when you started looking at their analysis, such that they didn't really find what they said they found. And when you look at their numbers closely, there's reason to question the conclusions that were being drawn in the Coates analysis. Now again, further research can shed light on this and might be able to illuminate it. You know, I would argue that even if you can argue that in general corporate political spending was hurting companies, that wouldn't necessarily mean that you'd want to back shareholder proposals in this area. It might be better something left to the business judgment of the management and the boards and a sort of a traditional business judgment rule. Clearly, there are times where companies need to be engaged in the political process if they're heavily regulated companies or what have you, and or if their competitors are doing so. So as a general rule, I'm not sure that if the question were answered in the affirmative that this hurts share value the way Coates is asserting, that it would say you need to vote for this. But I also think there's a lot of reason to doubt that claim. And I think in general, an institutional shareholder looking at this ought to be pretty skeptical of the proposition that corporate political spending hurts share value. Now, when it comes to various types of disclosure being requested, that's a question that we can't really answer empirically. And so we'd probably want to look at those on a case-by-case basis.
Well, thank you, Jim. Thank you for joining me today to talk about this very important topic and sharing your research and insights.
Thanks for having me, Isaac.
Once again, this is Isaac Gurdetsky, Project Manager at Manhattan Institute Center for Legal Policy, and I was joined today by James Copeland, the Director for the Center for Legal Policy. Thank you for listening.